I can feel the ripples and pull you from the stream. Yeah, the stream. Oh, yeah, I can feel the ripples and pull you from the stream.
Well, you certainly won't hear that special acoustic in-studio version anywhere else. Cruising the Decades and Good Neighbors with Ripple Acoustic. Cruising the Decades is heard on 62 great independent public radio stations worldwide, from St. Louis to St. Cloud, from Pescadero to Pittsburgh. Find all of our playlists and listen on demand at cruisingthedecades.com.
Over 100 years of music history. In the course of just 1 hour, you've been listening to Cruisin' the Decades with Brad Savage. This is the global edition produced for shortwave, FM, and AM stations worldwide on the leading independent community and music radio stations on the planet. This program originates at WAPS-FM, The Summit, in Akron, Ohio, USA. For correspondence or QSL, contact Brad at thesummit.fm. Thank you for supporting independent, eclectic radio broadcasting and signals over the air from all corners of planet Earth. One broadcast to an audience of many, simultaneously. A shared listening experience. Radio and 100 years of music. Join us next time for the global edition of Cruisin' the Decades.
WRCT Pittsburgh.
And the hits just keep on coming.
Now radio.
Yeah.
WCT.
Now Radio.
Hiding somewhere beyond the rain, meeting for the light, storming.
Melissa from Michigan. I work an extra part-time job serving lunch at my child's school, but I still can't afford to put food on our table.
Daniel from California. Choosing whether to pay the rent or pay to fix the car to get to work doesn't leave us with much at all. Now we can't even pay for meals.
Hunger is a story we can end. End it at feedingamerica.org. Brought to you by Feeding America and the Ad Council.
WRCT Flashback.
Feeling sweet, feeling drops from my fingers. From WRCT Pittsburgh.
Forbes Avenue is a production of WRCT Pittsburgh. The opinions expressed are those of the participants and not necessarily those of WRCT, its members, or Carnegie Mellon University. Email questions or comments to pa@wrct.org.
I'm Richard Gordon. Today on Forbes Avenue, we present the first part of an interview I recorded in August 2022 with John Scalzi, whose science fiction has delighted readers for decades.
Joining me on the line right now is
a very prolific author, John Scalzi. Hello, John.
Hello, how are you?
I'm doing great. Now, John probably isn't going to want to brag on himself, so I'll just tell you he's won multiple Hugo Awards. He's past president of the Science Fiction and Fantasy Writers of America. He's author of one of the longest-running blogs on the Internet, and he's written lots of different kinds of speculative or science fiction, if you will. You are certainly prolific.
Thank you. I try to be. If I don't be prolific, I don't eat. It's a high correlation between those two things.
One of the things I didn't know about you until recently was you started out as a journalist, and one of my favorite nonfiction books of yours is The Rough Guide to the Universe.
The Rough Guide to the Universe was actually a dream project for me because when I was a small child, I wanted to be an astronomer. And then I had something happen, which is that I stopped being able to do math right around the eighth grade. And unfortunately, that is really terrible for wanting to be an astronomer. Later on, when I started writing books, my very first book was The Rough Guide for Money Online. Yeah. And because that they had a good working relationship with me, they said, well, we'd love to do another book with you. What would you like to do? And I was like, I want to do an astronomy book. And they were like, Rough Guide to the Universe makes sense to us. And so I got to do that. And it really was like a life achievement thing for me. I was so, you know, I felt so fulfilled. It's kind of funny to be thinking about, I'm a science fiction author, and that's how I, you know, sort of made my name. But this astronomy book was actually one of the, you know, life goals and one of the things I'm the most proud of.
It's a really accessible read. You know, you don't sound like an egghead. You sound like somebody explaining it to someone so they can understand it.
Right. And that's kind of the intent. I mean, I would have been really happy to be an egghead. If I had been able to do math, I would have gone full egghead route and never looked back. What I can do is really be an enthusiast. And especially with science writing, I do believe that so many people are actually kind of a little intimidated by science. They think that it's just this thing to be put off over to the side. And the simple fact of the matter is that almost 80% of anything can be explained to everyone. It's that last 20% that you sort of have to have a little better understanding. But if you can get that 80%, then you've given people actually a decent view of the world. And so I think there's really something important about the people who are science popularizers. You know, when I was growing up, you know, one of my big idols was Carl Sagan. And he had just such a great touch. He was a planetary scientist. He, you know, he had the chops as a scientist, but what he was genuinely skilled at was taking his enthusiasm for that universe and showing it to people and making it something that they felt like, yes, I get this. I this makes sense to me. So if I could do 1% of what Carl Sagan did, then I would have counted myself lucky. And with, like I said, with The Rough Guide to Astronomy, I got to do that, be the person saying, look at the universe. Isn't this cool? Hopefully people were like, yeah, yes, this is cool.
I was doing an interview with some musicians, and I was packing up. I mentioned that my next plan every was John Scalzi. And the fiddler raised his eyebrow and said, red shirts. I think it's a great place for someone who's not familiar with John Scalzi's work to start.
Well, the idea behind red shirts is something that is actually extremely familiar to science fiction fans. In Star Trek, the original series, they would go down to a planet, and it would be Kirk and Spock and Scotty and Ensign Jones, the security officer in the red shirt. Now, somebody's going to die, right? And who's going to die? Is it going to be the three people whose names are in the opening credits? Or is it going to be this poor, sad sack security person? And we all know the answer to that. And so over time, the name Red Shirts has become synonymous to, you know, basically the person who is sacrificed for drama. Somebody's got to die to up the drama. Who is it going to be? Somebody who is expendable. So I had been writing science fiction for a number of years and had been involved in science fiction and engaged with science fiction. And everybody knew the science fiction trope of the red shirts. And yet nobody had written a novel about it. And I was genuinely confused about this. I was like, why? It's right there. And the reason was that it's a 5-minute joke. Everybody gets the you know, come on, Ensign Jones, we're going down to the planet. And Ensign Jones is like, oh, okay. You know, that, and that's it. That's basically as far as anybody thought about red shirts. But I was like, now, wait a minute. These people are expendable for drama's sake, right? Because they only exist for five pages. But those characters, presumably, they went through Starfleet Academy. They had rich internal lives. They had people who loved them. You know, they their lives had meaning. And so part of the question was, what happens when the red shirts, who are fully fledged individuals, realize that they are being sacrificed for drama? They eventually be like, enough of this, and they try to change their fate. And again, it was really interesting to me because when Red Shirts came out, there were some people who have been, you know, in the science fiction community and been readers for years, and theirs is like, yes, yes, Red Shirts, we get it. We just don't know why this was, you know, something that needed to be expanded to novel length. And then, of course, people read it, and the answer was because who amongst us has not ever felt like a red shirt? So like somebody else is the main character and we're all ballast and we're like, I don't like this. I don't think this is good. And it's about agency and taking control of your life and doing all of that sort of stuff and funny at the same time. So, I mean, that's kind of how that happened. And now the great thing about it is like, I attached it to an old contract that I hadn't fulfilled. So it was like for very little money. And so, and it really was a book that we were like, oh yeah, we'll put this out. People will like it or they won't. It's fine, whatever. And then it exploded and it got, you know, onto the New York Times bestseller list and went on to win the Hugo for best novel. And honestly, nobody was more surprised about the success of Red Shirts than I was. I just thought people would be like, oh yeah, this is cute. Where's our next Old Man's War book? But ironically, it was the one that really sort of cemented my success. And I'm forever grateful for that, honestly.
It sure reads as if you were having a blast writing it.
I was having a blast writing it. It was one of those books, every once in a while, an author will be like, oh, yeah, it basically read itself. And you're like, you're a liar, right? Because books bite you a lot of the time. But Red Shirts was one of those books that genuinely sort of wrote itself because I knew what it was about and I knew where I was going with it. And because, again, it was attached to an old contract that I hadn't fulfilled and so not for a lot of money, I didn't worry about it. I was like, I'm going to do silly things that I wouldn't normally do and not worry about whether it's commercial or not, because it doesn't have to be commercial. If it makes a minimum amount of sales, I will still earn out. It'd be perfectly fine. So having the pressure off and just doing what I decided that I wanted to do made a real difference through that. And so the lesson that I took away from that is stop stressing about whether or not you are going to earn out your advance, just write what you think is cool. The fun of the book is taking what people's expectations are for the scenario and the characters and all that sort of stuff and messing with them.
Except for the God engines, I think your writing style is generally, well, I hate to say snarky, but it's snarky, even in moments of high drama.
Sure, absolutely. And I think that that is part of what people come to me for, right? So I had this ridiculously long contract with Tor. It's a 13-book contract. And part of the reason that Tor went in long-term with me for this contract is that we all understand that there is a certain thing that I do, right? That is to be snarky and entertaining and page-turning and thoughtful, but not at the expense of getting you from one chapter to the next. This is what I write is essentially very commercial, very accessible fiction. And because I do that, and because everybody agrees that that's what I do, that's why my publisher is like, yes, have this ridiculously long contract that will basically keep you writing until you are close to retirement age. That's okay with me. I mean, it's sort of the thing of every artist becomes known to some extent for their shtick, if you want to call it that. You know, it's like most bands have a particular sound. Most actors are known for a certain type of role and so on and so forth. And you can fiddle with the formula and stuff like that. But at the end of the day, this is what you're known for. And so for me to fulfill that role is not actually a problem. One, because I enjoy writing in that particular way, but also because I think that there is value for the science fiction and speculative fiction genre to have someone who is basically low barrier of entry, right? Mm-hmm. That you can say to a friend who wants to read science fiction but has never read science fiction before, oh, I have a book for you, and then you hand them Old Man's War or Red Shirts or Kaiju Preservation Society. And it's super easy to get into, and you don't feel like you have to have read the history of science fiction to get to that point. Now, once you are in the door, there's a whole world of other science right. fiction authors and speculative fiction authors who are chewier, who are doing more innovative things and so on and so forth than I am. But you got to get them through the door first. So I often sort of compare myself to a carnival barker, the guy mm-hmm. who's like, hey, come on in here. We got some spaceships for you. You like aliens? We got aliens. You know, get you through the door. And then you can go wild with what you see inside. And so that's the assignment. Now, from time to time, you bring up the God Engines, which is actually really interesting because the God Engines, it's a novella that I did a while back. And I did it for a small press called Subterranean Press mm-hmm. instead of for Tor, which is my usual publisher. And the whole point of that was like, so all the things that I do really well, I'm not doing them because it's not cheerful. It's not optimistic. It doesn't rely on dialogue and humor. And everybody, and this is not a spoiler, it's been out for years and years, everybody dies at the end. I mean, horribly, right? And I had so much fun writing it, but as much fun as I had writing it, oh, absolutely, it was a blast. Because it was stuff I didn't normally do, so I was getting to put extra tools in my writing toolbox, you know? But even more fun for me than the writing of it was watching people read it. And they're like, I just finished reading God Engines. Do you need a hug? Right? It's just incredibly bleak. And I love that because it does two things. One, it does remind people that although I have a very commercial, very accessible shtick that I do, and I'm happy to do it, it doesn't mean that's the only thing that I can do. As a writer, I'm capable of doing other things. But also, I think that every once in a while, it's good, you know, to shake up your own, as a writer, your own expectations of who you are and what you do, to try out different clothes, so to speak, and see how they fit and learn from those things that you're doing differently, how you can incorporate them into what you're doing in your usual stuff.
Your fiction is not just space and alien stories. I mean, the ones that I probably find scariest are the lock-in novels.
Oh, sure. Sure. The lock-in novels, writing about a pandemic and before we had a pandemic, which was really sort of interesting because, of course, the COVID era sort of came around, and the lock-in books have a disease that initially infects like 25% of the population, and then 1% of the people are eventually locked into their bodies, unable to communicate even though their brains are working. So we develop technology to allow them to communicate with each other and with the rest of us. And when COVID struck and people were looking at how the progression of COVID went as a pandemic, they came to me and they were like, how did you know? How did you got this? You nailed this. And I'm like, it's A, basic epidemiology, and B, how humans work. So it's not a surprise to me that in fact, things went very similarly between what I wrote in fiction and what happened in the real world. And I wasn't the only one. There were other writers who have written about pandemics who have done a very good job of it because, again, it's basic epidemiology and basic human nature. You put those two things together and, you know, it's not too surprising. But, again, when you're in the middle of a pandemic and you're, you know, told to stay home or you'll die, and you're reading this book about a pandemic where people are told to stay home, it sort of hits differently than it did in 2014 when it came out and people were like, ooh, a pandemic, that would be bad.
You use some science fiction or speculative elements here to really advance the story and make some references to sort of contemporary society. I mean, the with the threeps, you know, named after C-3PO, sure. unless they were called,
right.
or what are the people who didn't like them called?
They would call them clanks.
But I mean, the whole idea there of that's the epidemic and then the technology of the androids. Those two little science fiction tricks, if you will, let you make lots of different points about people in society.
Absolutely. And I will say this, because the lock-in books are meant to take place within a couple of decades of current time, whenever right. the current time is. And it is much harder to write near future fiction, which this is, than far future fiction. Like, for example, I have a series of books called The Interdependency,
right.
and they take place about 1,500 years in the future, right? And so any prediction that I make of what the universe is going to be like 1,500 years in the future, no one's going to be able to check my math. We'll all be dead, right? Mm-hmm. So I can write whatever I want. No mm-hmm. one's going to complain. I guarantee you that in 2034, which will be the 20th anniversary of lock-in coming out, somebody will come up to me and said, you said we would have X, Y, and Z by this time, and we don't. Why didn't you predict it right? How does it feel to be a failure? You know, because it's so close to current time. And it's one of those things that you really do have to remind people that, you know, quite frankly, if science fiction and speculative fiction writers could actually predict the future, we would not be writing science fiction. We would be doing investments, right?
Right.
But the other thing is that we don't model the future. What we do is we use the future to talk about what's going on in the present and what our fears are and concerns are and so on and so forth. So that being said, it is much more difficult to do that and have it 20 years in the future than it is 100 or 200 or 500 or 1,500 years in the future.
We are chatting with John Scalzi, the prolific science fiction author who is still writing and writing and writing. There are just so many tricks that you do when you write that I just love. I mean, for example, in the Kaiju Preservation Society, there's one section, I think it's maybe one or maybe two paragraphs long, in which you communicate that several months or several weeks have gone by having this conversation in which two characters talk. Instead of it being all at one time, each time you mention a different food delivery that's being made.
Yeah. One of the things that I do, and I think this is partly because part of my experience as a journalist was being a film critic. So I spent quite a lot of time watching how story was done in films, is that I do a lot of work in story work and dialogue. And I do a lot of what are basically seamless transitions in dialogue, because that just is a quick way to do things. And it's been kind of fun being someone who has that particular writing skill set. There are things that I'm good at. Dialogue is one of them. Humor is another. There are things that I'm terrible at, which is writing description, which is why almost none of my characters, unless it's directly relevant to what's going on in the plot, are ever like described. Like, do they have red hair? Do they have blonde hair? Are they brunettes? You know, that sort of thing. Unless it's directly referenced in the story, it's not something that I do, because, you know, that's not a skill set that I generally have. But the thing about dialogue that's so much fun is we communicate so much just talking to each other. If you ever really just talk to your friends, the amount of information that you get from them just talking about the thing that happened to them today, and all the in-cluing that we all do, all the context that we give just through speaking is fascinating. And that particular scene where you're talking about, where somebody's doing a food delivery and they're having a conversation between the person who's delivering the food and the person who's receiving the food, and they're just sharing, it's all exposition. I'm all giving stuff that right. you need for the story, but I'm doing it in a way that doesn't all of a sudden stop the story and be like, and now here's a wall of exposition. Don't get me wrong, I love doing a wall of exposition. I have done like entire walls of exposition, but as the Cookie Monster would say, that's a sometimes food, right. as opposed to something that you do every single time. Whereas dialogue is, you know, a tasty snack that you just can't stop eating.
And you often do internal dialogues where a narrator or a character you're following at a close proximity is talking to itself.
Sure, absolutely. Well, and the thing is that, I mean, I do that all the time. I have the, you know, I have the voices inside my head just going with the back and forth. And it's not like it's like it's a completely different person. It's like, no, that's actually my brain. I'm speaking to my brain. This is this is just two aspects of me, so I feel okay with that. But it is one of those things where I bounce stuff back and forth in my brain all the time. And so much of writing is finding a way to get people the information they need without it being boring, right? And so if you can do that by internal dialogue back and forth with your with yourself, if you do it through dialogue between two people, if you can do it by having someone read a brochure about their brand new body, which is something that I actually had somebody do in Old Man's War, that is where my years of doing marketing had finally paid off, then it's fun to do, and it's something that makes it go faster because you're not all of a sudden stopping everything to go, oh, by the way, here's all this information that I have to tell you about before we can go on because you won't get the joke otherwise. Okay, ready?
After I recently reread the Interdependency novels and The God Engines, I decided I was going to go reread James Blish's A Case of Conscience.
Sure.
All of a sudden, I realized, well, this is really hard for me to get through because there's lots of monologuing.
Right. Well, there's actually even a term that we have in science fiction for that, which is, as you know, Bob, right? which is the way that we have to give you something that, you know, you absolutely need to know. And so you have one scientist speak to another and be like, as you know, Bob, the sun is a ball of plasma. Now, that said, I mean, I have absolutely done the as you know, Bob thing, but I make sure that when I do the as you Bob thing, that I have the person be level appropriate.
Right.
Like in Old Man's War, I'm talking about how we get around the faster than light thing, because I don't believe that faster than light is a thing that should ever happen. You have to find some other way to do
it.
And I'm having one person explain it to the other person. Every once in a while, that other person will be like, well, what about this? And the guy will be like, you don't have the math for that, right? Which is literally my way of saying, I don't have the math for it. Therefore, I am not going to pretend that I do, because the instant I do that, there's going to be actual mathematicians and physicists and engineers to be like, you know, you got that wrong.
John Scalzi, this is fantastic. But one thing we really need to do, because you are also one of the most accessible popular writers out there, is tell people about your blog.
Oh, boy. So in 1998, I decided that I was going to start writing a blog. And the reason I did that was because I used to be a newspaper columnist.
Right.
And I thought, one day, a newspaper will call and be, John Scalzi, you're just the man we need to do a column. So I wanted to keep up with the format. So I started writing a daily blog basically to stay in column format. And the newspaper thing never really happened in a serious way. I've done some newspaper writing, but never back to the weekly column sort of thing. But the blog has continued. And so this will be its 24th year next month, September 13th, as a matter of fact.
That's incredible.
And wow. I think about that, right? It is the longest I've ever written anything. And it's been really interesting because, like I said, when I started it, blogs were just starting out. We didn't even have the name blog yet. They were still online journals. And then, of course, there was the big blog moment, which is the first part of the aughts, where everybody had to have a blog and they were sexy and cool and all that sort of stuff. And now, of course, the blogosphere is completely, you know, it's the rust belt of the internet, right? There's hardly anybody there anymore except for a few people like me. And I feel like, you know, it's sort of like I want to go over to TikTok and shake my fist at those kids with their dances and whatnot. But, you know, but the thing about the blog is it still serves the same purpose. I write about whatever I feel like writing about for that particular day. Sometimes it's politics. Sometimes it is what my cat is doing. Sometimes I talk about being a writer. Sometimes I do reviews of technology that I've just bought. It's basically the place I go to muse. And it's had a huge impact on my life. I mean, Old Man's War, I serialized it on my website. And because I did, that's how I sold the book, rather than submitting it the normal way. An editor came and saw it and was like, can I buy that? And I was like, you mean you will buy it and I don't have to do anything? Absolutely, you can buy it. And then since then, I've had, I think at this point, 7 books that were either originally from material that was from the site, or were because I serialized a novel and put it up on the site. So it's been a huge boon for my career. And also, and I think this is really important, I think it's extraordinarily important for writers and really any creative people to have their own site that is under their control, not under the control of, you know, Facebook or Twitter or AOL, to give an example of an organization that used to be the biggest public tech company out there, or Friendster or MySpace, because to everything there is a season, right? There are people who probably believe that in 2022 they would still have a MySpace page and it would still be vitally important. And we are beginning to see that even the things that we think are entrenched, like Facebook, are beginning their slide, because it's no longer the Facebook era, despite the fact that it still exists. It's the TikTok era. Like, all the young people are over at TikTok doing TikTok things. And that's going to be a few years, and then there's going to be something else. So regardless of what happens, eventually something's going to happen. Those sites are either going to go down or they're going to slide to irrelevancy, and then all the stuff that you put on them, on Facebook, on Twitter, on Snapchat, whatever, is just going to turn into digital dust. But if you have your own site, at the very least, right, there is one place they always know they can find you. No matter what happens to my Twitter, you know, handle, no matter what happens to my Facebook page, at the end of the day, Scalzi.com, that's where I will be.
The other thing that's interesting to me is that you actually engage sometimes with the comments that people make.
Oh, absolutely. And I think it's been really useful in a number of ways. It's been useful for me because it's taught me actually patience in having online conversations, but it's also made it very clear to me that the sort of libertarian ideal of a free-for-all discourse is kind of a pipe dream. You actually have to set rules. It's like, look, this is my house, right? This is my house on the internet. You can't come into my house and take a dump in the living room. You actually have to be polite to me, your host, to all the other guests, because they are my guests. You can have a spirited and even contentious conversation, but you have to accept the fact that there's a real person that you're conversing with and that you're discussing the idea, not the person themselves. And if you can't do that, if you can't see the person, then I'm going to ask you to leave. You know, first I'm going to put you in moderation, which means that I look at your stuff before it actually shows up. And if in moderation you're still being a jerk, then I'm just going to say, here's the door, off you go. And it's been really important, because I think what happens is, over time, because most of the commenters who comment on whatever now have been commenting for years, and they get it, so that, you know, when there's conversations there, they actually have some value. And so I'm actually really proud to say that the internet maxim of never read the comments is actually something that you don't have to pay attention to when you come to my site. Actually reading the comments can add quite a lot of value to the site. And part of that is because we have rules. And it makes me really happy that is a thing that actually happens on my site that doesn't happen a whole lot of other places.
My thanks again to John Scalzi for spending so much time with us at WRCT. Since we recorded this conversation in 2022, John has published several novels and novellas. My personal favorite is called Starter Villain. It came out in 2023. The Shattering Peace, book 7 in Scalzi's Old Man's War series, is due out in summer of 2026. Thanks for listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
Forbes Avenue is a production of WRCT Pittsburgh. The opinions expressed are those of the participants and not necessarily those of WRCT.